Next item six, ecosystem service valuing. This is an informational item. We won't be voting on it.
Good afternoon, Chair Imason, members of the Board of Forestry, State Forester Peter Dougherty. My name is Brandon Ketzel. I am the principal economist for the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Partnership and Planning Unit.
Thanks.
2 years ago, a little bit of background on why we're here. 2 years ago, which, as I was just thinking about, went by really quickly. After the January 2017 board meeting, when we presented the economic analysis for the riparian rule change, we had feedback from the public and from the board on ecosystem services. More pertinently, we were asked the question, could we come back at a future date and possibly give a presentation on what are ecosystem services? And then go a little bit further and talk about how they could be valued and maybe look at some actual examples of how this was being done. And so over the last few years, Peter and myself met with each other, and then we went to OSU, and we asked the two gentlemen to my right, Drs. David Lewis and Randy Rosenberger, who is a full professor of applied economics in the College of Agricultural Science, and the Dean of Student Success, respectively, in the College of Forestry, to come back and join us for two presentations, possibly. Who knows what that'll look like. But this is presentation one, and what we've asked Drs. Lewis and Rosenberg to work with us today on is to talk to you about a background on ecosystem services and you know, what are they, help define those, and talk about some ways that they should be looked at and they've been valued. But really, this is going to count on a little bit of feedback on your end as well at the end of it, because we're planning a second presentation. So what would be useful at the end is for you to help us think about what that next presentation should look like. Should we talk about case studies? Should we talk about more about how ecosystem services should be valued? And so we're hoping for a little bit of feedback at the end. But one thing I want to point out is this, as Chair Emerson said when I sat down, this is an informational item. There's no action needed today except for hopefully a little bit of feedback at the end. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Lewis and Dr. Rosenberg and let them take control. So thank you.
Thank you, members of the board, thank you for welcoming us here today. So I'm Dave Lewis. This is Randy Rosenberger. And so we're going to talk about ecosystem services today. We're both active researchers in the field of environmental and resource economics. And so we're going to talk about them mostly from that perspective of active researchers in that area. Okay. So ecosystem services are generally defined as benefits that people derive from functioning ecosystems. And people have tried to classify them in many different ways. And this is a common one here that originates in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, a big international effort in the mid-2000s. And that's referenced in the paper cited at the bottom. You can classify, one way to classify them is provisioning services such as raw materials, and timber would fall under this particular area and is generally considered an ecosystem service. Regulating services, things like pollination, soil formation, climate regulation, these types of things. Cultural services, so that ecosystems could be a place for recreation, aesthetics, other things like that. Supporting services, things like this is where you might put habitat for wildlife if you were to try to classify them as an ecosystem service. And so what I want to do in this presentation is give you some examples. So if you look at this, this is very abstract, and a lot of stuff about ecosystem services is fairly abstract. So I'm going to try to use a lot of examples today just to kind of make it a little less abstract. And so here's one example. So let's focus on Oregon timberland. So this is a piece of Starker Forest timberland west of Corvallis. This is an area that I actively mountain bike on a lot, so I know it well. So there, you can think about those categories of ecosystem services from this particular piece of land. So in terms of provisioning this land, because you Douglas fir trees, so for timber. In terms of regulating service, it sequesters carbon, trees that grow, soil, sequesters carbon. Cultural services, mountain bikers know and love this particular section. It has a famous trail called Word to Your Mother that drops down through there. It's a great mountain bike trail for anyone in that area. It also has supporting services, like habitat for birds, right? And so as economists, when we think about these types of services, one of the questions that we like to think about is, well, what does Starker, as a landowner, get compensated for in terms of all these services that this particular land provides. And when you think about it, is really they get compensated for the provisioning service, the timber that comes out of that land. But these other services, they generally do not get compensated directly for, at least in terms of financial. And so what that means is the incentives to provide these other services are not nearly as high as the incentives to provide things like timber, okay? And so this links back to a way that economists like to think about what markets are efficient at providing and what markets are not efficient at providing. And so one way that we like to think about this, this is sort of, if you look at any economics textbook, you'll find a figure like this. This is a way to start to think about goods as public goods or private goods, and then things in between. So we think about things, classifying things in terms of whether they're rival in consumption and excludable. So rival in consumption in terms of along the top, things can be yes or no. When excludable, yes or no. So what does rival in consumption mean? It means that when I consume a good, that my consumption of that good directly takes away from, say, Randy's ability to consume that good. So if I go buy a board of lumber from Home Depot, Randy cannot go buy that board of lumber because I'm now using it. Okay, so then we call that rival in consumption. So timber is a good example of something that's rival in consumption. Other things are not rival in consumption, especially information. So my consumption of information doesn't affect Randy's ability to consume that information. So we can classify things in terms of rivalness. Excludability is another one. That's along the left side there. So goods can be either excludable or not. And so what this means is, can you exclude someone from consuming that particular good, right? So if you think about timber, for example, I can be excluded from consuming timber. If I don't pay for it, I'm excluded from it. If I go to Home Depot and walk out with a 2x4, someone's gonna stop me and say, wait a minute, you can't get out of here with that without paying for us, right? If I go out to Stark or Forest Land and chop down a Doug fir tree, they're not going to be happy about it. They can exclude me from doing that, right? So along the top are goods that are excludable, and along the bottom are goods that are not excludable, right? And so common resources, things like harvestable species, tend to be something that, while technically you could exclude them, in practice we don't very well exclude these things. And then over on the bottom right are what we call public goods, which are both non-rival and non-excludable, right? And so things like wildlife existence, water quality, are things that are, we would classify as both of these. And the reason we kind of set these this type of a rubric up in thinking about ecosystem services is because this helps us think about markets, the idea that markets are really better at providing these excludable services rather than the non-excludable ones. And the reason is because if I can exclude you from it, then I can charge you money from it. And so then that gives incentive as a provider to provide that particular good. If I can't exclude you from it, it's hard to charge. So then it's hard to get compensated for those things. Okay. So this figure here is going to help us, I'm going to use several times, and I'm going to use this sort of define how we think about ecosystem services as a whole. And so we think about ecosystems as giving us ecosystem services. And in between there, there's a production function. Right, so how an ecosystem translates into ecosystem services. And I'll show you some examples in a moment. In economics, we think about decision-making as influencing these ecosystems through human actions. So there are different things that people will decide along a landscape that will alter ecosystems and that will then alter ecosystem services. And then what happens in terms of those ecosystem services can be translated back to the value of those ecosystem services. And this is where we can think about economic valuation methods that would help us translate physical changes, biophysical changes in ecosystem services back to what the social value or economic value is of those services. And then to complete the circle, you can think about that value as providing information to help think about decision making that then completes the loop, right? So this figure is fairly abstract. I want to walk through a few examples of thinking about this. And so I'm going to start on the right-hand side and this link between human actions, ecosystems, and ecosystem services. So I want to do this by referencing this paper that I worked on a number of years ago. It's cited at the bottom. And this particular paper is attempting to quantify the link between human actions and ecosystem service provision, in particular focusing on land use change. So this is a U.S. national model on non-federal land, so the entire country. And so what we're after here is trying to link policy and market scenarios and how those impact the net returns to using land in terms of different uses. So uses like forest, urban development, range, cropland, pasture. Those are the main land uses in the United States. And so modeling land use change, so how net returns to land give incentives to change land, and then how those land use transitions then give rise to these different ecosystem services at the bottom. And this particular study focuses on four: food production and timber production, so two provisioning services, wildlife habitat, a supporting service, and carbon sequestration, which is a regulating service. Okay. So here are some results from this exercise, which was a forward-looking exercise to 2050. And so if you look over there, column A, or what's labeled A there, that's land cover changes. And so what we modeled here is you can see transitions between cropland, pastureland, forest, urban, and range. So there's no increase in land, so if one use goes up, another must go down, okay? So the white bar is a baseline trend. You can think about that as essentially low crop prices, and the dark bar is essentially high crop prices, okay? So when crop prices were low and we simulated this out, you tend to lose crop and you gain urban and forest, right? When crop prices are high, you gain more crop in terms of 22%. You lose pasture, so it comes at the expense of pasture and it comes at the expense of range. Urban still goes up in all of these because it's so valuable. The things over to the right, B, C, and D, are ecosystem services, food production, carbon storage, and timber production. And we track how they each go up in these cases. Food production, part of the increase in that is an assumption about increases in yields over time. And then we also mapped these land use changes to changes in wildlife habitat, focusing on 194 individual wildlife species. We classified them in terms of amphibians, influential species, game species, and at-risk birds. And so we tracked whether they lost habitat, in terms of the left there, little or no change in habitat, or gains in habitat. And so there's a lot of information in this figure, but the main thing I want you to take away from it is that human actions that generate land use change alter ecosystems, and that changes ecosystem services, right? Part of this exercise was to understand what if we tried to compensate landowners for things that were not traded in the marketplace. And so we tried three different policy scenarios. One was forest incentives policy, which was $100 per acre per year subsidy on converting land to forest, and also a concurrent tax if you take it out of forest. So that's the green. So you notice that generates more forest relative to a baseline at the expense of crop and range primarily. It also generates less food production relative to a baseline, more carbon storage, and more timber production, right? So again, human actions lead to changes in ecosystems. We also did a scenario called natural habitats, which is essentially a policy to tax land that leaves range or forest and conserve those uses, and then an urban development or urban containment policy, I should say, that limited development outside of metropolitan counties. And then we linked those scenarios to all of these ecosystem services. And the point of the exercise is not to focus on any particular one, but just to make this point about how we can think about quantifying a human action influencing an ecosystem, influencing an ecosystem service. All right. And so these changes here are what we typically focus on in economic analysis of ecosystem services. Okay, so if we think about that exercise there, that was an illustration of the right-hand side of this figure, so the link between decisions, human actions, and ecosystem services. Now let's focus a little bit on the left-hand side over here. So, all right, these services change in biophysical terms. What is that worth? How do we think about what that's worth in terms of economic valuation methods? So the easier ones, it's not necessarily easy, but the easier ones are the things that are traded in marketplaces. So timber and food, for example, have observable prices as ways that so the market reveals people's willingness to pay for these goods and services. So we have ways to value that. This is an example of new research of mine with some other people in my lab that are looking at, this is measuring the county average annualized, this is an annualized measure of the net economic return to private timberland across the United States. And so the blue is more valuable, the yellow is less valuable, just in looking at this. And you can see here, like with this setup, that of course the most valuable timberland is both in the Pacific Northwest and in the US Southeast. My home state of Maine sadly comes out very low, in this particular ranking. So that's market goods. And now the thing with market goods is they have prices that we can use. Non-market goods are a different animal. They don't have prices that we can use. They're not generally traded in marketplaces. And so when we start to approach these particular services, then we have different methods that we come at it. These are known as non-market methods, non-market valuation methods. And kind of the two classic ones that are typically discussed are, one is called revealed preference, another is called stated preference. Revealed preference essentially uses information, data on how people are using resources and to try to infer something about their value out of that. So property markets are classic ways that we try to infer data. People are willing to pay more for houses that are in places with more quality environment compared to places with houses that are not. We also model recreation decisions in terms of thinking about the demand for those goods. Now those generate use values, and so these generate economic values that come from people's direct use of these services. Stated preference is another approach which measures non-use values, so the fact that people can derive economic benefits from ecosystem services even apart from direct use of those services, right? And so endangered species are sort of a classic case here where people can derive benefits from conservation or restoration of endangered species even without directly interacting with them. Okay, so as an example of revealed preference, the hedonic pricing method is the most one of the most common approaches. And this method is applied to ecosystem services, typically uses property values and recognizes the fact that property values reflect the value of the many different attributes of a property, right? So what goes into property values, the structure, so in terms of if it's a house, the size of the house, the age of the house, things like that, the local built environment around that house, the school quality, neighborhood amenities influence the price of that house, but also the natural environment. Proximity to conserved forest, for example, is something that's been shown to influence property values. Air quality also is another one that's been shown to influence property values. And so what we look at here with revealed preference is trying to measure how does a change in the natural environment affect property values. So as two examples, there's hundreds of examples in this area, but it's two particular examples. Many studies find that residential property values are higher when near conserved forest and other types of conserved open space lands. Right? So people find the amenities of being near those places attractive and are willing to pay for them in a property market. Right? And so we try to use those, tease out what that price differential is that comes from that amenity. Another example from my own research is the link between aquatic invasive species and lakeshore property values. When lakes get invaded by these aquatic invasive species, it lowers the aquatic ecosystem services, and hence you see properties selling for less on those lands after that. Right? Yeah. There's advantages and disadvantages to every method. For this particular method, the advantage is that it's based on revealed behavior of people, right? So people that are putting money on the table in these particular markets. Disadvantages, it covers a really small subset of ecosystem services, things that people are directly using. Recreation is a common one here. And it's also, from a research perspective, very challenging to disentangle environmental attributes from other property attributes. And so this ends up being a complicated statistical exercise of trying to disentangle multiple things. Another approach is called the stated preference approach. And this particular approach is attractive because it can get at both use values and non-use values. And in fact, it's the only way to get at non-use values of ecosystem services. An example is the choice experiment. And so what this particular approach does is it uses surveys to ask people to make choices across bundles of services, right? So a survey is sent out and programs are described to survey respondents. And so I picked an example here from this paper down here, which was the closest one I could find related to what this board is about here in terms of private forest land and the Oregon Coast Range. And so this particular study, done by OSU people several years ago, looked at defining a conservation program that had really four different sets of things that it was after. Salmon streams, so conserving salmon streams and salmon habitat, forest age management, biodiversity reserves, and endangered species. And so what you do in these surveys is the key task is you describe actions that affect a set of ecosystem services. So you do this in the survey and you tell the respondents what the actions are and what are the services that are affected by it. Once you do that, Then this next step here is, this is known as a choice card in this literature, is survey respondents then are faced with these choosing from different things. I can choose a baseline outcome that has no change, and importantly, costs me nothing, or I can choose from different alternatives that change where the levels of the ecosystem services are experimentally varied by the researchers, right? And it's kind of blocked down there, but at the bottom, hidden behind that right there by the camera is cost levels. Okay, so not only do you choose from different levels of ecosystem services, but the cost to the household is experimentally varied in there. And so what happens is researchers take choices that people make in these surveys and then try to disentangle from how those choices are made with the attributes, the level of the attributes, the ecosystem services, and the cost, try to disentangle how much people are willing to pay for changes in those attributes, right? So in this particular study, for example, that was conducted on Oregon households, and this was a male survey that was done, people were willing to pay on average about $60 per household for a 10% increase in salmon habitat, about $201 per household per year for a 10% increase in old growth management. And so what you do with these services, with these surveys, is you try to then, whatever attributes you are varying there experimentally as a researcher, you're trying to put dollar values on changes in those, which reflect what people are willing to pay for additional units of those services. These stated preference methods also have advantages and disadvantages. Key advantage is that they get direct questions about the values of interest, right? So you can, as a researcher, if you want to zero in on a particular ecosystem service, you can design the survey around that. So it gives you control over what you're trying to value. It also is the only way to get at non-use values. And this is really important, especially when you're talking about things like wildlife habitat or any types of threatened species. This is an important thing that you really can't get at with revealed preferences. There are also disadvantages. The biggest one that's been, and the one that's been studied for many decades, is the hypothetical nature of these. These are hypothetical rather than revealed. So they differ in that way, in that people are not putting money specifically on the table. So you're not using their revealed behavior to get at these values. It's more hypothetical. Another disadvantage is they're very costly to conduct these services. It requires a really high skill in survey design, and they're not cheap to conduct. Our discipline has not had the technological advances to lower those costs very much over the years, unfortunately. To wrap up, just come back to this same figure. And so the idea of valuation methods gets at this side here. And so ideally, right here, what I added is valuation of ecosystem services helps improve decision-making. And so that's why we think about doing this in the first place. And this is particularly important when you're talking about the ecosystem services that are public goods and that don't have market prices. And so landowners tend to not be incentivized to provide those. And so one solution to that could be for other entities to try to step in, like payments for ecosystem services was one example of doing that. But how do you define what payment to provide? Well, one way, ideally, is you would use information about what they're worth. Right, because this gets at the economic issue of the demand for these particular goods. And that's really one way to think about this, is the left side is all about demand for ecosystem services. This side over here, the right side, is about the supply of those services. Right? And we'll wrap up there and take any questions.
Well, I'll start out. I have one. I know you talked about these values are really marginal values, correct, for
yes.
The change. And one of the things that's emerged as a real problem in ecological economics is separating out what the marginal change of an ecosystem service is for a given human action. And then could you speak briefly to joint production of ecosystem services?
Let's go back to this slide here as an example. So What you're asking about is this link here, right? Is how do you link so changes in ecosystems to ecosystem services? That's right. So when you change land use, for example, as the example that I had up there illustrated, you change lots of things. So you change wildlife habitat, you change carbon sequestration, you change timber production, you change food production, and And really, it, for a lot of things, it's difficult to disentangle how much. And we don't really, there are some things that we know a lot about in terms of what this production functions look like, and there are other things that we don't know so well. But to really do this well in the ideal world, you want to have a good idea of what that production function looks like right there.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you both. That was very interesting. I appreciate that. How do we go about understanding what the effects are of these ecosystem services on the surrounding communities? So in other words, you might have a forest that's being managed in a certain way, and there are certain amenities associated with that. They would be different if we were managed in a different way. But people use that forest for certain things. They're bringing money to that area to recreate and do other activities. How do we get a handle on what the additive income is or additive benefit is to a community from these kinds of services? And I think I understand what you did, Dave. I'm not sure I followed it at all, but I'm not sure that what you did answered my question.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
No, it didn't. And most of the methods that we use try to get at individual measures of demand for these things. Rather than measure income directly, it tries to measure these values. And this is sort of the classic economic approach to, if I want to measure the value of something, the first thing I want to know is I want to know the demand for that, what people are willing to pay for it. And now that's linked tightly to income, because willingness to pay is about preferences and about your ability to pay. So these methods implicitly have income underlying them. But the methods that I talked about here are not specifically aimed at trying to understand how, say, income levels would change in a particular community. That's a different question.
Yeah, and so I can add to that as well, Brenda, that your question about community support and development is more tied to a different economic methodology. So this is dealing with what we consider values or benefits. So on the margin, we're trying to say, if you change A, how does that marginally affect these different things, and what are the relative values of that? So we're in kind of a cost-benefit framework that's helping us decide, should we go here? Another is more informational, and one that is widely used, and it's the economic impact analysis or economic contributions. So this is some of the statistics that we see, where the number, you know, the amount of expenditure, jobs, income, those types of things that are supported through active timber harvesting, through recreation investments, where people come to a community, spend their money, and the flows of those funds throughout there. So they're more of a description of how things are are working together, but they aren't good methods for helping us identify what the best course of action is. And one of the reasons for this is they're tied to cost. They're tied to what people are spending in a different area, and as the costs go up, the economic impacts go up. So things like we saw previously, a hurricane has a significant positive economic impact on a community, because the construction and redevelopment and all that brings lots of income and jobs for a short amount of time into a community. But from a valuation standpoint, we would say that was a horrific event with how those go. And so the struggle with looking at the impacts on a community is that economic impacts cannot measure ecosystem services directly in a broad sense that values can. Does that sort out a little bit?
I just want to thank you. It was a great presentation. Really wonderful work. I guess my other comment is, whoever came up with the name Ecosystem Services should probably be strung up. But love the work. Thank you.
They were originally called Nature Services by Gretchen Daly. And then later it got more, it got into the realm of
it's got a history, yeah. Right.
They didn't have focus groups or
no. We got to do some branding work here.
Yeah, so I really appreciated the presentation today. I think it gave us a good sort of solid, comprehensive joint foundation for understanding what ecosystem services are and how we might go about valuing them, given that some of them are monetized, some of them are not, and the different ways you can measure them. Just as a suggestion for where I personally would like to see you go next, and at least a good part of, although certainly not the only reason that we got you on the agenda, was I really felt a strong need following our riparian rule analysis to get a better handle on how we're incorporating costs and benefits related to ecosystem services in our economic analysis when we're making land use decisions. I would love to see some suggestions for how we might go about improving our, for instance, economic analysis of the state management planning process that we're in, so that we know that we have at least come as close as we can to understanding the economic trade-offs that we might be facing with as our decisions are shifting between those, but the provisioning, regulating, cultural, and supporting surfaces that we get. Because while the ones that are monetized, it's very easy to understand what the economic trade-offs are. The ones that are not monetized, it's very difficult to understand what the economic trade-offs are. Although I agree with you completely, as you stated, just because they're not monetized doesn't mean they don't have economic impacts. And so getting a better feel for how we can incorporate an understanding of the monetized and non-monetized economic costs and benefits of different alternatives that come before us would be particularly useful.
So let me start with that. So I think this figure actually gives you a way to start to think about that for, you could apply this to a lot of different settings. And so in that setting, so if you say expand something about a riparian buffer, then the question that you want to, first question you want to answer is in terms of the production function, what does that do to the ecosystem services? So for example, fish populations, what is the link between that action and how many returning salmon, for example, come in, right? So that would be this map down here. So getting a handle on that would be first. And then once you have a handle on that, then valuing what are people willing to pay for example, more fish, higher populations of returning salmon. And so then if you take those steps there, then what you'll do is you'll be able to understand something about the change in an ecosystem service in biophysical terms, and then the change in economic terms. And then if you get the change in economic terms and you do it well, then that's in the same units as timber values.
Right.
Okay. So if an action like that lowers timber values because you're taking some productive land out of production, but in the trade-off is that you then raise the, say, number of salmon that come back, then there's economic value to that. Then you can directly weigh those in the same units. And that's, is from an economist's perspective, that's really the idea here in terms of why we think about valuing things in monetary terms. It's so that you can now compare things in direct units. Because if I don't do the valuation step, then I could have something where, okay, I have X number of dollars that are lost in terms of timber values from this action, but I have X number of, or Y number of fish that come back. And so those are not the same units. And so what you want to do is make sure they're all in the same units.
Yeah. And I think that's, I'd love to hear even more about both the conceptual framework that allows that and also some sort of practical applications that we might use in Institute as, to give some guidance for future economic analyses about decisions that might be before the board, so that we're not left with half of the story or a story where we're comparing apples and oranges.
Yeah. Okay.
I would, just curious, have you seen that where it's actually played out in decision making, and do people treat dollars of salmon the same as they treat dollars of timber?
So I think it depends on what context you're asking in there. So in terms of, so if you think about it in terms of, let's say a public policy agency, then the question is, do you consider economic analyses of benefits and costs? And just as one example that comes to my mind, so the Environmental Protection Agency, Federal Environmental Protection Agency, regularly does cost-benefit analysis for, say, major air pollution laws across the U.S. And the benefit estimates that come out of those are uses a lot of the same methods that I mentioned here. And the cost estimates that come out of those are usually about costs that firms must undertake, for example, to lower pollution. And so that's a direct example of where these types of methods are used to compare something, a benefit that's not monetized directly by a market, against things that are.
Yeah, and we've certainly, so I've seen where dollars of salmon are treated the same as dollars of timber, just not in the same analysis. But certainly every year that National Marine Fisheries Service is setting harvest out in the ocean for the commercial fishing industry, they're looking at dollars of salmon. And so they're talking about harvest level dollars of salmon out in the ocean. So they're not comparing it against a land use change. And that's the link that we're having trouble making. But certainly they're basing their decisions on dollars of salmon.
Although those are actual prices for salmon, right? Dead salmon? I mean.
Yeah. That's right. But essentially, I think what I would love to see when you come back to us is some guidance and assistance in helping us get a feel for what, in fact, would be a comprehensive economic analysis that tries to fully incorporate an understanding of the trade-offs between all four categories of your services, including the provisioning, the ones that are monetized, and those that are not. So that and looks at, you know, basically, I think we have seen, you know, if, to use your example, if you increase the riparian area, you are taking some trees that we might have otherwise harvested as a provisioning benefit, and there is an economic cost associated with that. But we're in the past, we've looked at that in isolation without counterweighting that or completing the story of that with, and what is the economic value or impact of the value we gained by changing the riparian area. And I think, you know, we're kind of struggling because it's not an easy analysis. But I would like to have some guidance on what you would think would be a reasonable and good comprehensive framework for conducting a comprehensive economic analysis of our future decisions.
Yeah, that's good. That's good feedback. Thank you.
You know, what's the elements of adequacy? When do we know we've looked at it enough to be feeling like we're making an informed decision?
Great. Thank you very much. This is really interesting. And we will now take a break. Or let's see, until a 15-minute break, so until 3:50.
Chair Emerson, members of the board, Claire Clock, retired farmer, Clock Farm in Corbett, Oregon, and semi-retired conservation district for Clackamas, here today to say that I sort of consider this a red letter day or a watershed event for the Department of Forestry and the fact that you even have ecosystem services on the agenda. We've been talking about this for, 40 years? First time we've heard about it, or whatever you want to call it. But the thing that's happened in that all that time is there's never been any hard numbers, and I know it's really hard for hard numbers, but just like Board Member Williams mentioned, we need something that says something about what the actual benefit is from these two particular types of services. Just a couple of case in points that I would think of too is the fact of what a forest does a clear cut does compared to a like a shelterwood or a limited entry type of a cut has to do with the groundwater holding in. If you have a complete watershed with a clear cuts, the water runs off faster. We don't have groundwater infiltration. Our groundwater levels aren't recharged at a good rate. And then those people that depend on those water in August and September for in the streams, they have dried up streams. And we've seen those all the time. It was mentioned this morning on that kind of thing too. As also the actual cost of ecosystem services in relation to recreational use, the dollars that we have. I'm a bird watcher. I'm not a life lister, but I'm a bird watcher. And people do mountain biking, the forest, and all those small communities do get an economic benefit from those particular services in the as far as nationwide, billions of dollars are spent each year in small communities because of that type of stuff. The other thing is, too, in relation to like streamside buffers, the ecosystem services of that, is what's the downstream effect of having erosion in your streams, whether it be increased treatment of your drinking water treatment plants. If it's all of those things that OWEB does and our restorations do, you have erosion that comes into the streams and covers up the reds. All of that restoration money is lost in that particular thing. And in that particular point, we're talking about the streams that are non-fish-bearing streams that maybe not have the production in forest practices that they should have, because mud from the upper streams will kill a salmon egg just as bad as the mud from a fish-bearing stream. But that's the main thing. I think the suggestion is that was thing is some good hard facts that we can say, hey, this these kinds of this forest here will provide these kind of services. And I'm not against cutting, because when I testified on the Elliott Forest, I suggested that they thin the entire forest. That's just my experience there. And I would say that for the state and federal forest too, is that we have a backlog there, both for forest protection and for fire. So I can see both sides of the way, but I hope that we can make advancements in ecosystem services. And I'd just ask our presentation panel to come back for some numbers. Anyway, thank you. And any questions?
Okay. Thank you for coming. Anybody have any comments or questions? Great. Thanks a lot.